Welcome to another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. Today I'm delighted to be talking with Nathan Singer. He's a novelist, playwright, composer, and experimental performing artist from Cincinnati, Ohio. Nathan's books include the critically acclaimed novels A Prayer for Dawn, Chasing the Wolf, and In the Light of You. He teaches writing at Northern Kentucky University and the University of Cincinnati. Welcome, Nathan.
Thank you very much.
I found your newest book, In the Light of You, to be just riveting. Kind of like watching an accident in a way, because it's horrible and yet it's fascinating. Watching these two characters, Michael and Sherry, as they come of age inside a neo-Nazi group. Can you talk about what prompted you to write this kind of a book?
Well, I started with the character of Sherry. Michael as a character actually didn't come along until right before I started forming it into the novel that it is now. Strangely enough, and this is going to sound very odd, but I was reading a music magazine, actually a heavy metal magazine in high school, and there was an advice column, you know, type of thing, and this girl had written in, her situation wasn't exactly like Sherry's, but it kind of lodged the idea into my head of this girl being the girlfriend of a neo-Nazi and not entirely sure how she felt about it and how did she end up in this situation in the first place and where would she go from there. And also the twist with her character was sort of implied in the letter as well, although obviously I took it somewhere else. And I just started formulating the story around her, you know, and once I had that idea, all the other characters just kind of showed up, you know, as they were needed, you know. But initially, Michael as a character was, when I was initially thinking of making it more of a third person, he was just one of the goons, you know. He was just, you know, one of the other skinheads in the group. But once I decided to make it first person, the character just kind of, came out of the darkness, so to speak.
Well, I'm curious about this because you started with Sherry, and yet the book is written like the character is writing his memoir,
right.
And it's Michael's.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the story comes from Michael's point of view. There's a few chapters that seemed like they were Sherry's point of view.
Uh-huh.
So what happened? How did that shift for you in the writing process?
Well, for me, I mean, the character of Sherry is pretty much unchanged.
Okay.
From the point when I first developed her to the way she is in the book now. And I kind of felt like if the story was from her point of view exclusively, that it wouldn't be all that – it wouldn't be as interesting because I feel like her motivations are kind of clear, you know, why she does what she does. And I was always kind of – watching her, you know, as the writer, I kind of sort of felt as if I were watching her from a glance, you know, from a distance. And so it sort of made sense to me that the narrator, whether it was third person or first person, would kind of have the same, like, you know, observational position, you know. Michael has who Sherry is and who all these other characters are in his head, you know, from his perspective, you know, in accordance to, you know, how they relate to him. But you know, as hopefully comes through, his perspective might be a little skewed.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious about the kind of research you did for this book because as a reader, it felt pretty brutal and real.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering where that comes from as a writer. Where do you get that kind of feel? Do you actually go hang out with skinheads? What happens?
Well, not exactly, but somebody had asked me at what point how much of this book is autobiographical, and if I were to be completely honest, I would have to say between 70% and 75% of it's autobiographical.
Huh.
But you know, then the first thought is, well, you know, certainly you must have spent time with neo-Nazis, and the amount of time I've spent with neo-Nazis is very small. You know, I try to avoid, you know, people of that sort as much as any reasonable person would. But I have, you know, I've run with fairly violent groups of people at different times. Not that I've, you know, participated in that sort of thing myself. But one thing I notice is that gang behavior and gang mentality is pretty universal. I mean, the reason people join gangs, regardless of if it's the Crips or the Hells Angels or neo-Nazis or anything like that, it's kind of for the same reasons. So, it was fairly easy to apply, circumstances I was very familiar with firsthand to this model, without it being too far off,
So in a sense, you're telling your life story, but it's not your life circumstances.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and the character of Michael is nothing like me as a person, but he's kind of the idea was once I had that character, I applied a lot of my own life experiences to this different character. And of course he reacted to it completely differently than I did.
Wow.
And completely, because his motivations as a character are different from my motivations as a person. So that it dictated fundamental changes in the story because of, why he behaved the way he did.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm curious about the violence. I find that as a writer, when I'm writing about violent or difficult things, I'm kind of a crabby person to be around. So I wonder how it affected you to write, because there's some pretty brutal scenes in the book. So I'm wondering how that affected you.
Strangely enough, not as much with this book. My first book, A Prayer for Dawn, I think affected me more psychologically than this one did. I don't quite know why this is, and I probably have to ask a psychiatrist, but even though I am not by nature a violent person, and I tend to deplore violence and as it manifests itself in real life, for some reason I have a knack for writing violence, and I couldn't quite tell you where that comes from. I think because when I am in the vicinity of violence taking place, I absorb it in a lot of detail, and that's why it's fairly easy for me to re-channel, so to speak,
Well, I'm curious about that. This is a show for writers, so people who are writing and are having to sit down and kind of figure out how to do this. So one of the things I noticed in reading the violent scenes is that they were very visual, and I could see what was happening. How do you plot all that out in your head? Do you just see it and then write that down, or how does that happen so that, you keep the people in the right places? And
I see it and I write it down as I see it. I don't know how other writers, would approach that sort of thing, but that's basically the way it happens. For me, if I sit down to write a scene, I pretty much I've already seen it from beginning to end. In every detail, and I just basically write it down as I see it.
So when are you visualizing the scenes, and when are you writing? Do you spend like a lot of your walking around time thinking?
Yeah. I don't consider what I do at the keys to be writing.
Uh huh.
That's just typing. I write everything in my head prior to ever sitting down. The creative process is largely over by the time I actually start putting words on the paper.
Wow.
Yeah. Particularly with my first two books, and this probably comes out of my theatrical tradition, but a lot of what those two books came about was from my performances, from my spoken word performances, and so on and so forth. This one is the first one that I actually kind of outlined or came up with it with a kind of a real basic skeleton, but I found that probably the stuff that works the best is when I strayed from the outline. So that particular model doesn't work for me as well as it obviously does for other writers.
So can you give me a little picture of what a day looks like if you're working on a book? How this works with your brain and how it works with other people in your life who are, you look like you're walking around, but you're like, no, I'm writing, man. Don't talk to me.
That's exactly what it is. There was plenty of times, not so much with this book, but with other books, my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, she would come down and it would be 4 a.m. and I would just be sitting in the living room completely in the dark, not doing anything. And, she was like, what are you doing? I would say, I'm writing, and that's what I was doing, and that's the way I write sometimes. Sometimes, it's just out walking around. If I am actually doing the creative process while I'm physically writing, I'll pace around the room. I'll kind of act out the different characters. In fact, my second book, Chasing the Wolf, I hung a large mirror behind my computer and I acted it out into the mirror as I wrote it. And that's usually what I'm doing. I probably do look like a schizophrenic. So, you know, well, what I'm writing.
Well, tell me about your theater background. I know you're performing a performance artist. So tell me about how the theater background kind of helped you create this process.
I don't know exactly. It seemed to be the most comfortable for me. I started out as a musician. Like, music was my focus for many, many years, and that's where I kind of assumed I was going to end up. And the music that I was playing and the music that I love was fairly violent, fairly intense, you know, kind of high-speed, high-action kind of music. And when my band, my principal band, disbanded, I was just sort of thinking about what I was going to do next, and I was like, I wonder if I can have a comparable impact on an audience without the music, just me, you know, and words. And so I started doing this really kind of confrontational, high-intensity spoken word art, you know, performance. And I saw that it was, you know, it was having a very strong impact on people. And it was much more immediate because there wasn't anything to fall back on. You know, it wasn't like there was guitars and drums and bass and stuff going on. It was just me, you know, and it made it kind of even more intense and more visceral. And I just sort of channeled that directly onto the page, you know, and that's where a lot of that comes from.
Wow.
Yeah.
And now your bio also talks about you being a playwright. So how is that different from the whole performance art? Is that?
Well, I mean, when I'm actually writing a play, it's a bit more disciplined, you know, because I have to write for multiple voices and there's an actual narrative involved and so on and so forth. I mean, there's plenty of spoken word that I do that isn't really narrative. You know, some of it's more, I guess you would call it urban poetry, you know, in that capacity, you know, although I do draw somewhat from rap and hip hop, I draw more from like hardcore and heavy metal, you know, so what a lot of slam poets do, as far as it being in the hip hop milieu, I do more in sort of a heavy metal milieu, you know, but it's a comparable approach, I think.
Say more about that, because I'm kind of having trouble picturing the hardcore and heavy metal with the spoken word. It's how you're, the rhythm of how you're speaking, or the things you're talking about, or...
Yes, all of that. And I mean, my stage presence, my volume, the type of language that I'm using, the speed, the aggression in which I deliver it, all very much comes from like a thrash or hardcore concept, you know.
Wow.
And that's kind of why I got the reaction that I did initially. It was sort of interesting becoming a spoken word artist. I actually became a spoken word performer before I was even really familiar with the art form. You know,
wow.
I'd never seen another spoken word performer the first time I had gotten on stage. I just sort of had a loose concept of what it was and what I wanted to do, and that's the way it was. And it was kind of comparable to when I was playing music, because the people that liked it loved it, and the people that hated it hated me for doing it, you know. I mean, I had a lot of walkouts, a lot of people threatened to fight me and stuff like that, and I was like, oh, this is working. You know?
This is good.
Right.
They hate me.
Exactly. I mean, I used to have a standard. I was just like, if I don't have at least one walkout or one outraged person, then the performance was a failure. I need to amp it up next time. You know?
So now you teach. Are you still doing spoken word?
Uh-huh.
Like touring, or how does that work?
Well, not as much as I used to. Also because I've grown up a little bit, I kind of feel like I've done the whole, you know, let's see if I can start a riot mentality, you know. And I think my work has a little bit more nuance now. It's not just all, you know, it's not just all pitched at a 10 the entire time. And actually writing plays, full, you know, two-act plays with characters and narrative and so on and so forth has kind of forced that discipline on me as well. You know,
huh.
It can't all be this one tone, you know. You've got to play with multiple flavors and multiple sounds, you know, in order to really get a story across, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I want to go back to the novel for a couple minutes. I was really interested in the fact that as a reader, although I had some trouble getting into the book at first, I was really drawn to Michael and Richard. And I think I had trouble getting into it because the whole idea of skinheads was kind of repelling.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden I thought, well, I really like Michael, and I was actually liking Richard. And I was thinking, what's this guy doing as a novelist that he's able to make this skinhead guy really appealing?
Well, when it comes down to it, like for me, although there is, you know, youth violence and racial politics and sexual politics are kind of the dressing of the book. The book
yeah.
is not about any of that. You
yeah.
know, it's not about racial politics. It's not about skinhead gangs. It's about charisma and obsession, you know. And,
yeah.
and I kind of feel like I could have told the exact same story in different contexts. They could have been office workers in the mid-70s,
hmm.
or they could have been, you know, they could have been in some other capacity. You
yeah.
know, the bottom line is Richard and Niani are both compelling, charismatic people. That's why
yeah.
they're able to get people to do what they do, you know, and why people follow them and love them and want to be near them and so on and so forth. And I was more interested in what makes, you know, what makes somebody have that. You
have
know?
That light that you talk about repeatedly.
Exactly, exactly. That's why the book is called In the Light of You, you know, because although it's framed in this particular context, you know, it's less about the fact that Richard is a skinhead and more the fact that he is this charismatic leader, you know, and the fact that he is doing something so negative and so repellent that hopefully the majority of the people that are reading it are just as disgusted and appalled by that sort of thing as I am. Makes it more interesting.
Yeah.
The fact that we can understand why these kids follow this guy. So even if we don't like him necessarily as a person, we understand, you know, we understand why Michael is there. We understand what it is that these people see in Richard, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, he had this incredible gift of hospitality. I mean, that was part of what made it so complicated.
Uh-huh.
'Cause he was so hospitable to these kind of wandering, lost boys.
Right.
And he was smart and a reader and, you know, all these really nice things that people like.
Right, right. And even within the context of it being this racist, there was nuance to it.
Yep.
You know, which makes it uncomfortable. I mean, it's real easy for us to say, it was like, well, this person is just ignorant. That's why they are the way they are. Those people are scary only in an immediate sense. The people that frighten me are the ones that actually have a reason for doing what they do.
Yeah.
You know, the Adolf Hitlers and the Pol Pots and people
yeah.
like that, you know.
I'm curious about what writers and artists inspire you.
Well, my two biggest literary heroes, hands down, are Kurt Vonnegut and William S. Burroughs, probably more than any others. You know, I draw influence from Yasunari Kawabata and Hunter Thompson and people like that. But, you know, I guess sort of the outlaw writers, I guess, you know, are the ones.
The outlaw writers?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, in the world of theater, Samuel Beckett was a huge influence on me.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but, yeah, that's where I draw a lot of my inspiration, you know, as far as writers go, you know.
And how about musicians? I mean, it sounds like a lot of your inspiration, at least from reading your blog, comes from music.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm still fundamentally a musician. You know, I mean, I'm every bit as much a musician now as I ever have been. It's just I happen to have gotten a book deal before I got a record deal. So you know, I'm known more as a writer. But yeah, I mean, all three of my books have a musical concept at its core.
Yeah.
You know, a Prayer for Dawn. It even says on the cover it's a thrash novel, and Chasing the Wolf is a blues novel, and In the Light of You is like a punk novel. You know, and I don't know if I'm going to keep that up forever. I'm going to run out of genres I'm interested in eventually. I mean, when I start writing a klezmer novel and a polka novel, I probably run out of ideas. But you know, as far as that goes. But yeah, I mean, as far as what music inspires me, it depends on the circumstance.
Okay.
You know.
And if you got a record deal today, would you be done with novels, or would you continue?
Oh, I would still continue to write books. Yeah, because it's, I mean, it's just as much. I mean, it's about 50-50 as far as, you know. And usually, I can't separate the two. I mean, a lot of times people think, oh, wow, you do all these different things, but I really don't. As far as I'm concerned, I do one thing. You know, it just happens to show up in different forms. But usually, I'll usually write an album to go along with each of my books just for my own use, just because it helps me keep the pace and the tone that I want. And in fact, my second book, Chasing the Wolf, we actually released the album that I wrote.
You
it.
Did?
Yeah, as part of as like a special edition, like the first however many books that had like a special edition CD that came with it.
So do you think you'll put your album for this book up on your website? Or?
No, because whereas that one, I feel like if you just listen to the music, it represents something that I love. You know, I love Delta blues music and so on and so forth. I feel like it stands on its own. I happen to not like racist hardcore punk at all, you know, or boy punk, you know. I mean, I think reading the book, you can get a sense of what the music would sound like. I mean, I don't particularly care for that music, and I wouldn't want my name on an album of that kind of music. You know?
Yeah.
So that one's just for me. Sorry.
Well, I hope you'll put your other one online, because those of us who didn't know about you then.
Right, yeah.
Didn't have access.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
So do you have a final tip to leave with our listeners, a writing tip or something?
Yeah, and it's probably kind of generic, but I feel like it works for me. A lot of people will say write what you know, and I suppose that's a good idea in theory, but for me it's write what you love, you know. Hmm. And if it's something that you don't necessarily know, or it's not something that you know about, the research is going to be part of the excitement, and that excitement is going to fuel the work.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes writing what you don't know is the best way to go. Somebody made an observation that I hadn't even considered, but it's true. I tend to write about things that I don't understand but fascinate me. You know, my first two books, two of the principal characters are visual artists. You know, they're painters and cartoonists, and I'm not a visual artist, but I find visual art fascinating. So that's why I wrote that character like that. You know, I don't understand bigotry. You know, I don't understand personally, you know, racism and homophobia and sexism and all classism. I don't, because it doesn't speak to me. So the fact that it exists and the fact that it's so important to people fascinates me. Mm. And that's why it, in the light of you, ended up manifesting itself that way, you know.
Wow.
So, write what you love, write what fascinates you. And if you don't know it, it's worth, you know, it's worth your time to find out, you know.
That's great, Nathan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Rochelle.
This has been another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. You can find a link to Nathan Singer's website and his new book at my website, rightnowcoach.com. Thanks for tuning in, and remember to always write.